This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Michael Deutsch from the People's Law Office in Chicago.
In a depressing piece of news, Ashkar, a Palestinian, received a completely and utterly unjust sentence for failing to testify in front of a grand jury.
We'll hear updates on the United Nations Committee Against Torture's report on tasers and on the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act. Who killed Che? We'll hear excerpts from the recent event at the Brecht Forum.
40 years after his death, there are still people out there who don't think the U.S. was implicated in Che Guevara's death.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. Well, Heidi and Michael, last October 23rd, the House of Representatives passed the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007, sponsored by Jane Harman, representative from California. Heidi, what do you know about the act? And Michael, what do you know about Harman?
Well, basically, the act amends the Homeland Security Act of 2002. It adds provisions concerning the prevention of so-called homegrown terrorism. And that's terrorism by individuals born, raised, or based and operating mostly in the United States. And I'm reading from the act here. It also directs Homeland Security to establish or designate a university-based center of excellence for the study of radicalization of homegrown terrorism. And finally, to conduct a survey of methodologies implemented by foreign nations to prevent radicalization and homegrown terrorism.
Sounds bad.
It essentially deals with what they call ideologically based violence. And that's what I think is most frightening, is it's thought police, in essence. That's the bottom line.
Sounds to me like they're going to have a bunch of little kind of Joe McCarthy committees going around the country, hauling homegrown social activists in front of them, smearing them, putting them on a list, making sure that if any kind of demonstration, say, goes on and something happens at a demonstration, they'll say, well, you're using violence. They'll go after these people like they do with the environmental people.
It's very similar to that. Basically, it defines violent radicalism as, quote, adopting or promoting an extremist belief system for the purpose of facilitating ideologically based violence to advance political, religious, or social change. But they don't define extremist belief system.
Okay, well, you know what here, Michael, it's actually worse than you're saying. They're not going to wait until you actually do something. This is really your point about McCarthy, I think, that you made earlier is right here. Because what McCarthy was about, or what the Smith Act cases were about, was essentially saying we can punish people for having the belief that they bring in a socialist or communist revolution, you need to have the violent overthrow of the United States, even if you don't take any steps toward it. So it punished the thought that you might need that. This act sounds quite a bit like what they're saying is here is that people who have an ideology that you may at some point have to use protest tactics that are violent, any kind of things that they consider violent, whatever that means, sitting in a street, going over a fence into a military base or an animal rights base, that they're going to be able to examine your thoughts based on the idea that terrorism is something you have to anticipate and you have to stop it before there's the first act. This sounds bad. Heidi has her hand up.
Well, my hand is up because an important part of this, and we saw this in the case of the activist called the Shack 7, is this bill charges that the internet, specifically the internet, quote, has aided in facilitating violent radicalism. ideologically based violence. And thus, we think this provision could be used to conduct even more intrusive surveillance of our internet and email communications without warrants.
You know, it was shocking to me that the bill sailed through the House 400-6. John Conyers, who's been a major disappointment, absented himself from the vote. Thankfully, Kucinich was there and voted against. But 400-6 was the support for Jane Harman's bill. Michael, what do you know about Jane Harman?
Well, you know, I don't know if we have to go much into personality. She hasn't been great on most of the issues we care about. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act hasn't been great on the Alien Tort Statute. You know, she's, I don't know if she's what they call, what do they call these people, blue dog Democrats or something. There's a whole set of Democrats who essentially are trying to bridge the so-called gap, if you want, ever want to think there is one, between the Democrats and the Republicans by being much more moderate and conservative, and they like guns and all this kind of stuff. I think Jane is one of those so-called blue dog Democrats.
Yeah, and a real militant in her own fashion with the Israeli lobby.
The six courageous individuals who voted against this were Abercrombie, Costello, Duncan, Flake, Kucinich, and Rohrabacher.
And the Senate is about to get a similar version of the bill. We'll report back to you on it, but I think it'll just sail through the Senate as well.
There is one other issue on this. You know, after the Smith Act cases were reversed eventually in the Supreme Court, they determined that advocacy alone is not sufficient to imprison somebody, or membership in a communist party, even if it advocates violent overthrow of the government, is not sufficient. We had a series of cases about the limits of speech, and a famous case is called Brandenburg. And really what it says is, if you're in front of a crowd that's carrying pitchforks and nooses, and you say to that crowd, you know, there's a guy over there, go lynch him, and it's likely that that's going to happen, that imminent violence is going to happen as a result of your speech, at that point you can begin to limit speech. That's pretty close to actually imminent violence. So the idea that this act is going way, way before then, when people are talking about, well, you know, this country is really awful, you know, it's terrible, we're never going to get equal rights for people without the violent overthrow of the current government, democracy isn't working in this country, we have to take action. That statement alone, it seems to me, under this kind of act put on the web could get someone into deep trouble.
You bet. I mean, I remember during the height of the McCarthy witch hunt era, they used books in their library to convict Julius and Ethel Rosenberg.
In the Shack 7 case, where the standard was, did the postings on the internet by these activists constitute a direct threat? And even though the body of the law showed that it didn't, the jurors were swayed by the emotional aspect of it and voted to convict. And I think that sort of shows the trend with juries now. And with language contained in this, makes it even easier for lawless convictions to occur.
And the other thing is that historically, violence that happens in the movement is more often than not violence in self-defense. And the cops are out there acting as provocateurs, and then they try to blame it on us.
Well, and also property destruction. And I think there's a big difference between acts of civil disobedience or sabotage that affect property versus those that are aimed at individuals.
A bad step.
I don't think anyone in Law and Disorder was surprised that the United Nations recently came out and said that the use of tasers essentially torture.
Well, no, because it was our own Dalia Hashad, when she started Amnesty International campaign here in America against tasers, came to WBAI and got the first taser story out over the air. But what does the police department say in their own defense, Heidi?
We know that Taser International Incorporated, which is one of the market leaders in what are called electronic control devices, ECDs, issued a statement essentially saying that the UN committee is out of touch with the needs of law enforcement. The use of tasers to control inmates and arrestees is consistent with our law. They say that taser devices, in fact, have saved thousands of lives around the world and dramatically reduced injuries by officers and suspects in every community.
When they came down with the law that said you couldn't get confessions out of people without having a lawyer instructed there, and the lawyer and the defendant being told that he has rights to get to a lawyer, they all said, this is the end, we're not going to convict anybody. And they always complain about everything because they would prefer no courts, no law. Bust any person on the street they just have a hunch they want to get, or a racist hunch they want to get, and give a third degree to them, and get them off the street. So that's their basic position. It's been their position consistently. So you can't take seriously their objection to a weapon that the United Nations has actually called torture. That's pretty serious stuff.
Sticking somebody with kind of like a fish hook and putting 50,000 volts into them, if that's not torture, what is it?
Recently, 36-year-old Robert Nipstrom died after being pepper sprayed, batoned, and tasered by police. We hear about it every week. The National Lawyers Guild has a police accountability project with a great listserv, and literally every day I read unnerving stories of tasers being used to abuse often helpless individuals, the elderly, people who aren't acting aggressively toward law enforcement. It's just become a national and international epidemic. Here on Law & Disorder, we followed the pivotal moments in the Mohamed Salah case. Earlier this year, Salah was cleared of terrorism charges, but was recently convicted of lying about his ties to the Palestinian group Hamas. He faces nearly 2 years in prison. The sentence for a minor charge of obstruction of justice comes as a major setback for prosecutors, who have spent a decade investigating charges that could have put Salah behind bars for life. Recently, however, in a much graver development, Abdelhalim Ashkar was sentenced to 11 years and 3 months in prison, just for refusing to testify before a grand jury. The judge applied sentencing guidelines terrorism enhancement, based on what the judge thought the trial evidence showed about Ashkar's activities for and knowledge of Hamas. We talk with Michael Deutsch from the People's Law Office in Chicago about this disturbing development.
You were at the sentencing, Michael.
Yes,
why don't you give
was.
Us a sense of who the two people were, what it was about, and I know you were the trial lawyer as well.
Okay. As many of your listeners might know, there was this big indictment brought against two political Palestinian activists in Chicago in 2004 with a big press conference by Ashcroft and Fitzgerald, the so-called terrorism slayer. And after a long trial of 3 months, the jury acquitted both defendants, Mohamed Salah and Abdelhalim Ashkar, of any involvement in terrorism. They were acquitted of a RICO conspiracy charge, but they were both convicted of much lesser charges. Mohamed Salah was convicted of not completely telling the truth on answers to interrogatories in a civil case brought by the Israeli lobby to destroy Palestinian organizations in the U.S., and Abdelhalim Ashkar, who's a doctor of business administration and ran for the presidency of the Palestinian Authority, was convicted of refusing to testify in front of two grand juries, one in New York in 1998 and one in Chicago in 2003. In New York, he went to jail for civil contempt for 8 months. He went on a hunger strike. He was force-fed. His veins collapsed. He suffered greatly, and ultimately the judge found there was no way to coerce him, and they let him out. He was then trying to get citizenship or stay here, and at one point he realized the U.S. wasn't going to give it to him, so he agreed to voluntarily depart. And 2 weeks before he was going to voluntarily depart, he was subpoenaed to another grand jury in Chicago investigating the same thing. They knew up front he wasn't going to testify because he's shown that in New York, and yet they put him in a grand jury in Chicago. He again refused to testify. He was held in civil contempt again and went to prison. And the U.S. attorney said later on that the only reason they put him in this RICO indictment, which they put him in after he was serving time in prison, was because he refused to cooperate. So now he was facing life in prison. He was let out on bail and charged with criminal contempt. There's no maximum sentence in the law for criminal contempt. You can get any sentence that the judge decides to impose. So we had
life in prison.
Up to life imprisonment, yes. And we've had this issue before around the FALN in Brooklyn, actually, where the people refused to testify in grand juries, were sent to prison in civil contempt, and then were charged with criminal contempt.
Right, Michael, I remember when you represented, those are the Puerto Rican cases.
Yes, yes.
But the maximum, I mean, there were a couple of, maybe, were there a couple of sentences, 3 and 3? I don't remember.
Yeah, they were 3 years. The government asked for 15 years in that case, actually, but the judge only gave them 3-year sentences. That's what they got.
We were outraged then, I remember. Yeah. We thought that was just incredible.
Yeah, exactly. And now we're faced with this situation where Sala gets 21 months for lying in a civil interrogatory, which happens every day in federal court in every way. He already had done 5 years in prison. But he gets 21 months, which, you know, unfortunately was an obscene sentence. But if he would have gotten a lower sentence, they would have appealed it. They can appeal the sentence now, and they could try for a higher sentence. And they asked for a terrorism enhancement, et cetera. But he had a lot of support, a tremendous amount of support. 600 letters were written from the community here, and the judge had to acknowledge that. He was not a danger. And she gave him this 21-month sentence because lying is such a serious crime. When Asghar came up, the government filed papers saying, well, his refusal to testify was akin to accessory to terrorism because the grand jury was allegedly investigating so-called terrorism, and he refusal to testify. He didn't lie to the grand jury. It's not a perjury charge or lying. He just took a political position, a principled political position, which, as we all know, for 40 years, people have been doing that. You know, it's called non-collaboration. You don't go in and testify against your movement. As a result of that, he had his sentencing the day before Thanksgiving. The government said that she should get the terrorism enhancement. We're dealing now with sentencing guidelines, which are allegedly not mandatory, but judges apply them. And the judge found that he was eligible for the terrorism enhancement, which meant that his sentence, which should have been, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 years, now went up as much as 20 years. And he gave a long speech.
What did he say in his speech, Michael?
He spoke almost 2 hours. He talked about his whole history, the history of his family, beginning with his grandfather, who was interned by the British during the efforts to oppose the British mandate, and about his father, who was an activist, and about all his family members, several of them who have been killed by the Israelis, several others who have been imprisoned, how his whole life has been suffering and trying to get justice for the Palestinian people, that he was dedicated to that he would never cooperate, he would never be an informant against his people, and that he was proud to stand in solidarity with his people. The judge used his statement against him, saying, well, you showed no remorse. You indicate to me that you would do this criminal act again, and sentenced him to 135 months, which is an obscene sentence, an outrageous sentence.
It's over 10 years.
Yeah, Michael,
it's 11 years.
11 years.
I understand that after the sentencing, you had some words with Fitzgerald.
Yeah. We were in the courtroom. Fitzgerald was there sitting in the front row. And
this is, for listeners, Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney.
Who did what?
Prosecuted Scooter Libby and supposedly is this terrorist fighter and fair-minded man and a non-political U.S. attorney, which is all baloney in my view.
What did you have to say to
him? Well, one of the things here, Ashkar's sister-in-law was killed in New Orleans in a criminal murder, which has not been solved. As a result of that, Asghar's took in the 8-year-old son of his sister-in-law and has been raising him for the last 3 or 4 years. And the boy was there, and the mother-in-law was there, and his wife was there. And as the judge pronounced the sentence, they all began to cry hysterically. And the mother-in-law began to scream in Arabic, you know, denouncing the court and denouncing the proceeding. Fitzgerald stood up, you know, as if he was going to take names and bring indictments right there. And I basically just turned to him and said, oh, yeah, the Scooter Libby case, what did he get? You know, what was his sentence? Mm. And, of course, as you know, he got pardoned by Bush, but even his sentence was 4 years. And he lied to the grand jury on several occasions, and he covered up, and et cetera. But, of course, Asghar, who's a Palestinian and who was trying to protect his people who are living under such, you know, extreme conditions, is now considered a terrorist and is sentenced to, you know, 11 years in prison. So we were all just totally outraged by it and very upset about it. Dr. Ashkar is one of the most gentle, loving men. Even the judge had to say in his sentencing that there's no evidence that he had anything to do with violence, that was involved with violence in any way. And what message does this send to political activists? That if you're subpoenaed to a grand jury and you take a principal political position, I mean, you can go to prison for a long time. And it's a very dangerous precedent, and it kind of negates the whole political motivation of people who refuse to testify in grand jury. It brands them as guilty of the offenses that the grand jury is investigating.
How old is Dr. Ashkar now?
He's about 49.
Are you appealing this?
Well, I would hope. He's represented by a lawyer by the name of William Moffitt, who's in Washington, D.C.
Who used to be the head of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Yeah. I would assume and hope that he would appeal the sentence. But, of course, we're dealing with the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, which is led by Judge Posner, and is a very reactionary court. And Posner has written about special rules and laws for terrorists and even advocated that reasonable doubt standard be eliminated for those charged with terrorist crimes. I think the case should be appealed. It should be fought. It should be exposed. But I am not hopeful that the Court of Appeals is going to do anything about that sentence.
This sounds like a perfect example for a strong people's movement, and I think that we've got to get the word out. Exposure, as you say, if people know about this, there should be strong support, another letter-writing campaign perhaps?
Yeah, one of the things I'm most concerned about, and I'm seeing it with Mohamed Salah already, Mohamed Salah was allowed to voluntarily surrender. The judge in her sentencing said he should go to a medium or minimum security prison, that he wasn't a danger. When he arrived at the prison that he was designated to, which was a medium security prison, he was immediately put in the hole. He's been in the hole ever since, which is almost a month now. He's in a freezing cell with no soap or hot water. He's been denied normal visits or phone calls. And basically, they're keeping him locked up as if he was a high-security terrorist.
And how are they justifying that?
They won't even respond to us, but what they're saying to him is, well, we're keeping you here for your own safety. There may be people in the general population of the prison that might be a danger to you, which is absurd to the extreme. They knew for a month before he arrived he was coming to that prison, and if there was any problem, they should have transferred the prisoner, if there is such a prisoner, out of there. So now he's suffering in a high-security lockdown because allegedly his life is somehow in jeopardy. And you know that Ashkar is going to go to either Florence or this special unit they have at Terre Haute now, where mostly Muslim prisoners are locked up without the right to contact visits under high security monitoring.
Even though the judge acknowledged that he had done nothing violent and wasn't a threat.
Yeah. Once you get in the hands of the Bureau of Prisons, the judges wash their hands of it. They don't really, they say, oh, well, we can't do anything about it. And even though the judge found that, and even though she specifically said Salah should go to a minimum or medium security prison, he sits in the hole. And we're trying to get Congress to move on it. We're trying to deal with the judge. And we're trying to, you know, organize all his supporters to protest it.
Is there a website where listeners can go for more information and a call for action?
I think you should contact me at the People's Law Office. My email is mdeutsch, D-E-U-T-S-C-H, 45 at AOL.com. I can pass on whatever letters you want to write.
Great. National Lawyers Guild will put something up on our website.
Great. That's wonderful.
And so will Law and Disorder.
Okay.
Hopefully next time we have you on, we'll have some glimmer of hope. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay, take care, guys.
Yeah.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org. We go now to hear excerpts from speeches at the Brecht Forum from Michael Smith. The event was titled, Who Killed Che? Let's have a listen.
My name is Michael Smith, and I'm on the board here at the Brecht Forum. I wanted to thank Liz and the staff, really, for this whole month of activity. It's really quite wonderful to come in here and see the art display and see you all and have a chance to spend a month talking about Che and his contribution. I'm with two of my friends and comrades. Jane Franklin is the author of Cuba and the United States, which is a chronological history of American intervention into Cuba. You could write another volume.
Really?
Len Wineglass is the attorney for the Cuban Five. The Cuban government wanted to find the best civil rights lawyer in the United States, and they did. And so far, they're winning. I'm going to talk about Che and what brought him to Bolivia and how he died and who killed him. But Che's death was just part of a whole, really half century or more attack by the United States on Cuba that continues. So Jane's going to put it into context, and Len's going to finish up with what's going on currently, particularly with respect to the Cuban Five, who I'm sure all you are familiar with. 15 years ago, my friend Michael Ratner did a FOIA request to the FBI asking for their dossier on Che. And 15 years ago, unlike today, you could actually get things like this. Ashcroft has issued an edict saying to the various government bureaucracies, don't give them anything and we'll litigate for you against them. So you can't get this stuff anymore. But he used to be able to get it. And he told me that he had three boxes of stuff in his basement. And what did I think we should do with it? And at the time, I was representing Ocean Press, which published Jane's book on Cuba. And I had read Jane's book on Cuba. And I thought, you know, Ocean Press publishes all this stuff on Cuba. Maybe they'd be interested in Che's dossier. So I emailed them, and they wrote back immediately saying, absolutely, we're stopping our press on the catalog for the spring season. We'd like a proposal from you, and we'll do it as quick as we can. So Michael and I sat down, and we went through all three boxes, and we picked out what we wanted to print. And Debbie Smith, who's sitting in the back, did the copy editing and put it together for us. And we shipped it all off to Australia, and 6 weeks later, we had a book. Che Guevara and the FBI. You can't get that excited about it. You're not going to find the smoking gun on who killed Che Guevara in this book. But nonetheless, it's very interesting. We went down to Havana to launch the book because we knew if we had a book launch in New York, no one would come. When we launched it in Havana, we had about 100 different press persons there, and it was global news. And we even got a review on the front page of the Budapest newspaper. It was wonderful. After we came out with the book, which was, all proportions guarded, a bestseller amongst leftist books, we were asked to go back to Cuba 2 years later and do a book on who killed Che. So we went back. We interviewed Che's wife. We interviewed the head of intelligence, who was the liaison between Che and his group and the Cuban government. We interviewed the two Cubans who are the main biographers in Cuba of Che, Kupol and Gonzalez, who wrote the book A Brave Man. And I read a lot. The most helpful book I read, even though I think that he comes to the wrong conclusion, it's a book by a historian and former Foreign Service officer named Henry Butterfield Ryan called The Fall of Che Guevara. I put it all together and I wrote the introduction to this book. The Cuban who was supposed to write his chapter didn't do it. And Michael got busy on something else and Ocean Press never asked us to do more and nothing ever happened. And they tell us the book is still going to come out. But this was 8 years ago. So in the meantime, I've got some notes on who killed Che and really what I think led Che to carry on the struggle in Bolivia that I want to share with you. Che was the oldest of five children. He was born to bohemian, aristocratic, iconoclastic parents. His mom was 3 months pregnant when they got married to start with. They ran a household where there were no fixed hours for eating meals. The children would ride their bikes through the back door, through the living room, and out the front door. People would come over at all hours of the day to drink wine, smoke cigarettes, and talk. His parents were atheists. Che grew up as an atheist, and when, as a kid, they formed a soccer team in the neighborhood. The soccer team was made up only of children that didn't believe in God. They were a small team, and they lost most of their games. Che's parents were anti-fascist activists, as was Che, who denounced a Nazi professor in college. So Che grew up in a political household. He also, when he was 2 years old, was struck with asthma, which he never got rid of. So he was mostly homeschooled. By the time he was a teenager, he had read all of Freud, Bertrand Russell, Aldous Huxley, Emile Zola, London, Lenin, Communist Manifesto, much of Das Kapital. He kept five philosophical notebooks, which he organized by country and author and subject. He wrote a long essay on Karl Marx. He wrote another one on Lenin. He loved Lenin. He said, Lenin lived, breathed, and slept socialist revolution. He got a summer job as a merchant mariner, and then another summer, you know, from the motorcycle diaries that he traveled around. He habitually kept a diary. He went to Chile, saw the copper mines. He went to Bolivia and saw the tin mines. And he wrote with his characteristic caustic wit, the Yankees have taken everything and left the native people only an ox. So in the dossier that we got, the CIA is always asking the question, is Che a communist? Is Che a communist? And then after the Cuban Revolution, they're asking the question, what kind of communist is he? Well, he was an internationalist communist. He went after medical school. Well, let me tell you another anecdote. One of the interesting things we came upon and put in the book together was the CIA agent who actually slept in Che's tent in the Sierra Maestra during the Revolutionary War. And the guy was Arnaud de Boschgrove. Remember, he was with the Washington Post later on. But he spent a whole week with Che. And he wrote that Che smoked long, stinky cigars, that he himself never bathed, that he was very nice to his men, and he was quite popular, and that at night he'd read from French novels to them, and that he seemed to be quite intelligent for a Latino. Che went to medical school, didn't study that hard, dreamt of being a great research doctor and finding the cure to some dreaded disease, got back from one of his motorcycle trips, and this not-so-intelligent Latino passed 10 medical school exams in 10 weeks, got his license to practice medicine, and went immediately to Guatemala, where he wanted to be a doctor in a clinic. He looked for a job for 11 months in Guatemala with no luck. He was a photojournalist while he was there. He did meet someone who knew Fidel, who was participating with Fidel in the Mikado attack. And that comes to play a little later on when Che gets kicked out of Guatemala and goes to Mexico and meets up with him again. But in the meantime, when he was in Guatemala, the CIA overthrew the government there. There was a reform government. The government took some land from United Fruit. Dulles was the attorney for United Fruit. The land was fallow. They weren't even using it. And they took the land and they gave it to the peasants. Well, this caused the United States to put a guy named Armas on the payroll. Armas was a colonel, a furniture salesman. They put Armas into Nicaragua and Somoza trained him, and the United States armed him, and he came back to Guatemala, and they overthrew the Jacobo Arbenz reform government in 1954, and Che hid out in the Argentine embassy. He finally got out of there, and he went to Mexico, and he met up with his friend who had been with Fidel in Moncada, and his friend said, "I'd like you to meet Fidel." So Che goes out to dinner with Fidel. And Che took with him from Guatemala three truths. One was that you have to have land reform in these impoverished third world countries, that the people have to be armed, and that the old repressive apparatus has to be dismantled. He meets with Fidel, and he says this about Fidel in his diary. He saw Fidel as a young man, intelligent, very sure of himself, and of extraordinary audacity. I think there is a mutual sympathy between us. Che was the third person to sign up with Fidel. The second was Fidel's younger brother, Raul. And their notion was to take this, and I've seen the thing, you couldn't even call it a ship. It's like a small yacht. You could fit three of them into this room, the grandma. And they took it from Mexico across the Florida Straits, and their notion was they piled 82 people on this. It's a miracle that the boat didn't tip over. They went across the Florida Straits, and they were going to start a guerrilla war against Batista, this American-sponsored dictator. And they got there a day late. They landed in the wrong place. Batista knew they were coming. They were ambushed when they landed in a mangrove swamp, and a dozen of them managed to survive the landing. Che was one of the dozen. Che was supposed to be the troop doctor. They came under fire. Che had a choice of grabbing the machine gun bullets or the medical kit. So he grabbed the machine gun bullets and headed into the hills. They regrouped. You know the history. The last great battle of the Cuban Revolution was led by Che and Camilo Cienfuegos. It was the Battle of Santa Clara. It cut the island in half. After that, Batista left. Came to Miami on January 1st, 1959. You know the great scene in the movie The Godfather. 7 days later, Fidel and Che and the rest of the guerrillas marched into Havana, and the Cuban Revolution started. Well, the last speech Che gave before he disappeared from the scene, he stayed in Cuba for 6 years and contributed greatly to the revolution, but he was getting antsy. And he really didn't want to be sitting behind a desk. And he wanted to go do what he had done in the Cuban Revolution. He first went to the Congo, as you know. I'm not going to talk about that. And then he went to Bolivia, which I want to talk about in a second. And before he went underground, he gave a famous speech in Algiers in 1965. And Che said in his last speech that because there are no frontiers in the struggle to the death, we cannot remain indifferent in the face of what occurs in any part of the world. A victory for any country against imperialism is our victory, just as any country's defeat is a defeat for all of us. The practice of internationalism is not only a duty for the peoples who struggle for a better future, it is also an inescapable necessity. Well, the Russians went nuts. The Russians, you'll remember, are the sponsors of peaceful coexistence, socialism in one country. The Political Bureau and the Central Committee detested Che. We have a report from Fyodor Bulatsky, who was Khrushchev's assistant. He told one of Che's biographers, John Anderson, "Even though Che was against our interest, there was still some sympathy for him. There was a romantic aura around him. He reminded people of the Russian Revolution. Opinion was divided. Some compared him to Trotsky." Well, Che gets to Bolivia in November of 1966. This book is full of speculation. Where's Che? They really didn't know. The guerrillas that Che organized in Bolivia took their first military action in March of 1967. So the imperialists knew that something was going on. They still didn't know it was Che, but they knew something was happening in Bolivia. Che had hoped in Bolivia to to repeat the experience of Cuba. He said, "The example of our revolution and the lessons it applies for Latin America have destroyed all coffee house theories. We have demonstrated that a small group of men supported by the people and without fear of dying can overcome a disciplined regular army and defeat it." That was the notion that he had in Bolivia. He thought that the spine of the Andes could be like the Sierra Maestras, that the Bolivian people would rise up, that it would spread to Chile and to Argentina and maybe beyond, and that it would take the heat off the Vietnamese, because Che had criticized the Russians for doling out aid to the Vietnamese Revolution with a teaspoon. He thought it would take the heat off Cuba. It was Che's notion, just like it was Trotsky's notion and the notion of Lenin and the original Russian revolutionaries, that you can't have a revolution in one country, that it has to spread or go under. And Che thought that internationalizing the struggle, first in Bolivia, would accomplish that. That's what he was doing in Bolivia. Well, what happened? By April, two of the people in Che's troop, Reggie Debray and another guy named Cyril Bustos, who was an artist, told Che they wanted to leave. And, you know, it's dangerous to have a guerrilla group and somebody leaves, because if they get caught and spill the beans, then it compromises the operation. But Che let them go, and sure enough, they were caught. And Bustos, because he was an artist, was able to draw pictures of everybody in Che's troop. So that's when they found out that it was Che. These men were brutalized and tortured. It's understandable what happened, but that's what happened. So come April, they know that it's Che in Bolivia, and what does the United States do? They immediately begin a tremendous counterinsurgency effort. They send a colonel from Vietnam named Pappy Shelton, who was then stationed in Panama, but he had learned counterinsurgency warfare in Vietnam, and he came to train 1,500 Bolivian troops, Pappy Shelton. They have an ambassador named Douglas Henderson in La Paz in Bolivia, who's a smart guy. And he says to the State Department, "We don't want to screw up here. We don't want another Cuba here. We've got to do this very delicately." Barrientos, the military dictator, this general, is truly a gorilla. So is Ovando, who's his buddy, and Torres, his other buddy. And they want toys from the United States. Now that they've got a little guerrilla action, they want jet planes, they want napalm, they want machine guns, they want tanks, they want all this stuff. Ambassador Henderson says, "No, you can't get it. We're not going to risk inciting the peasantry. Look what happened in Vietnam. We'll give you a few things. We'll train you. But there's going to be no American troops on the battlefield. We'll do the intelligence for you, but you're on your own." So they trained 1,500 Bolivian Rangers. They gave them everything from bullets to breakfast, everything. Radios, equipment, uniforms, everything. And these guys, you know, the Bolivian army didn't have a lot of self-confidence. It was like one of the worst armies in Latin America. So Shelton's got these guys marching around shouting, "We're the greatest. We'll never be defeated. We're the toughest." It was like ridiculous. But they were building confidence in these guys. And the intelligence was going to be performed by two Gusanos, two Cuban counter-revolutionaries who were working for the CIA. One of them is named, I almost said Alberto Gonzalez, excuse me, Eduardo Gonzalez. And the other is, of course, Felix Rodriguez, who you've heard of. Gonzalez's father was a used car salesman in Havana. Rodriguez came from an upper-class family, and he despised Che and the revolution and was really into it. I've had the pleasure of having to read his autobiography, Shadow Warrior. And he liked his work. He liked it so much that after he helped dispose of Che, he fought in El Salvador. He actually has a museum in his house in Miami, a museum. And he has in the museum a brassiere that he took from one of the commandantes in El Salvador. He also has guns and bullets, and He has a Rolex watch that he took off of Che. Che had wanted it to go to his son, John. This guy is close friends with George Bush Sr. He killed three Spanish citizens in the harbor in Havana. He did dirty work in El Salvador. He was part of the whole Iran-Contra scandal. This is Felix Rodriguez. He's living on our taxpayers' money in retirement in Miami as we speak. Well, Rodriguez and Gonzalez took care of the intelligence work. They were allowed. They dressed up like captains in the Bolivian army, and they were allowed inside the battle zone. Henderson was in La Paz, and Shelton is training these guys. This is in April. By August, the Bolivians are done training. They hit the field, all 1,500 of them. By August 31st, remember, Che dies on October 9th. By August 31st, there had been a detachment of Che's troop that had gone somewhere, and they got lost, and they never could find Che again. So his troop was cut in half right from the beginning. And that troop was wandering around. That was the detachment that Tanya was in. And they were ambushed at a river and all killed. So now there are 20 people left. Then three more were killed. So now there are 17 of them left. And by now, with the intelligence that's coming in, the Bolivian peasants are not supporting Che. A lot of them don't even speak Spanish, right? They're Indians. A lot of them are betraying Che. Che has run out of supplies. He's run out of medicine from his asthma. They're starving. He's emaciated. They're being encircled by these 1,500 Bolivian rangers. And by the 8th of October, the 17 remaining troop get trapped in the Churro Ravine. Che gets shot, wounded in the leg. His carbine gets broken from another bullet. He's laying there. They come and they find him. They're about to shoot him. He says, "Don't shoot. I'm Che. You found me." They take him, march him back to a little village called La Higuera. And in this village, there's a two-room adobe schoolhouse with a pressed mud floor and a thatched roof. And they throw Che and two other wounded guerrillas who soon die in one of the rooms. Felix Rodriguez shows up. Che talks to him for about 2 seconds and realizes that he's got a Cuban accent and that he must be a Gusano. Rodriguez attempts to interrogate him. Che wouldn't be interrogated. Rodriguez has with him a transistor crank-up radio, so he gets the message back to Langley. And he's also in touch with Barrientos in La Paz. Henderson says he never knew that Che was caught and only knew about it after Che was killed. If you believe that, you believe the Gulf of Tonkin attack, weapons of mass destruction, but that's Henderson's line. The United States line wasn't up to us, it was the Bolivians. Here they're saying that their client made the decision. The order to murder Che was transmitted by, on his own admission, Felix Rodriguez, who says, "Well, I could have countermanded it, but I remember that Batista let Fidel go after Moncada, so I didn't." The truth is, either there was a prior agreement to kill him when they caught him, or there was an agreement of that sort reached after they caught him. The records aren't there. Washington doesn't write down records like this. It's all circumstantial. But if you need circumstantial evidence of America's proclivity to assassinate foreign leaders, Bill Bloom has accomplished this in his book. At the end of the book, U.S. government assassination plots. From 1949 to 1967, the United States assassinated or attempted to assassinate 19 foreign leaders, including Chou En-lai, Sukarno, Kim Il-sung, Nehru, Nasser, Lumumba, Trujillo, Diem, and many, many times attempted to assassinate Fidel and Raul and even Che. So this is what they do. The Bolivians wanted Che dead because they wouldn't look good if he wasn't dead. It was a very shaky government. Bolivia was the most unstable country in Latin America. It had 50 different governments in 100 years. And the military government was very shaky there. So they wanted Che dead. The United States also wanted him dead. Because it would have been a big scandal if he wasn't. What would they do with him? Well, the cover story that the Americans let out was, we didn't want him dead. We wanted to take him back to Panama and interrogate him. Well, what are they going to find out from him that they don't know, right? But when Che was caught, Régis Debray was still in prison. And there was a huge outcry led by the Pope. He was an aristocratic French guy, and his mom knew the Pope. And even the Pope was denouncing the nature of the Bolivian government and its cruelties, and that they should let Debray go. So the outcry around Che would have been even worse. So I believe that the circumstantial evidence would lead one to conclude what I think everybody in this room has already concluded, that Che was killed both by Bolivia and the United States. I wanted to end with this thought. The amount of poverty in Latin America now, if it was 60 million poor people when Che was killed, it must be 120 now. I mean, desperate people. So why is Che remembered across the globe, even more so today than 40 years ago? Victor Hugo described in the following lines why Jean-Paul Marat, a leader of the French Revolution and also a physician, remains a timeless symbol of social revolution. They guillotined Charlotte Corday, and they said, Marat is dead. No, Marat is not dead. Put him in the Pantheon or throw him in the sewer. It doesn't matter. He's back the next day. He's reborn in the man who has no job, in the woman who has no bread, in the girl who has to sell her body, in the child who hasn't learned to read. He's reborn in the unheated tenement, in the wretched mattress without blankets, in the unemployed, in the proletariat, in the brothel, in the jailhouse, in your laws that show no pity, in your schools that give no future. And he reappears in all that is ignorance, and he recreates himself from all that is darkness. Oh, beware, human society. You cannot kill Marat until you've killed the misery of poverty. Viva Che.
That was Michael Smith from the Brecht Forums event, Who Killed Che? Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.